Lecture 4, Aristotle's Poetics, Character and Catharsis.
In this second of two lectures on Aristotle's Poetics, we shall shift our focus from plot to character and catharsis. Continuing to illustrate with examples from Oedipus, we shall explore how the tragic character must be good, appropriate, consistent, and true to life. And we will also explore the nature of Aristotelian catharsis and shall consider how this well-known word can be translated in at least three different ways. Let us begin with Aristotle's view of the proper tragic hero. I told you in the last lecture that plot was the most important, but character still is important, just secondary. And so Aristotle does spend time telling us what qualities a true tragic hero should have. And he says a tragic hero should have four qualities. One, he must be a good man. He should be neither immoral nor vicious. Number two, his character must be appropriate to his station in life. Number three, he must possess a likeness to human nature. Though heroic, he is a man. And fourth, his character must be consistent. Even if he is inconsistent, says Aristotle, he should be consistent in his inconsistency. Those are the four: good, appropriate, likeness to human nature, and consistent. Now, to these four, Aristotle suggests a fifth, and that is that the hero should properly be taken from one of the great tragic houses of ancient Greece. In other words, the tragic hero must not be a commoner. He should be a king or a prince. All right, let's stop now and illustrate these qualities using Oedipus. First of all, good. Although stubborn and a bit prideful, Oedipus is still a good king who loves his people and is devoted to truth and justice. Oedipus is good. A little stubborn, but he's good. He's a good king and he loves his people. Number two, we said appropriate. Well, Oedipus's love and devotion are befitting the nature and role of a king. But, and here's the little bit, so is his stubbornness and pride. I expect a king to be a little stubborn and a little prideful, as well as loving his people. To me, that is appropriate to the nature of a good king. Number three, he must possess a likeness to human nature. Well, although Oedipus is larger than life, he still possesses very human traits. He is flawed. He's not perfect. We can identify with him. Four, consistency, both within the framework of the play and throughout his offstage life, Oedipus is supremely and consistently the solver of riddles. He's always somebody that doesn't like mysteries. He wants to solve the riddle. He wants to find out the truth, particularly about himself. And so his actions are consistent. And that goes along with his stubbornness and his pride as well. So Oedipus fits perfectly these four qualities. In fact, he even fits the fifth quality because Oedipus is a member of the royal house of Thebes. At first he thinks he isn't, but it turns out that he is. He's a prince and eventually will become a king. All right. Although the hero is good, Aristotle says, he should still have a flaw. Tragedies are about good characters who have a flaw. And the Greek word for flaw is hamartia. And sometimes you even see that word in English. Now, I bet you've all heard this, and again, high school English teachers love this stuff. Hamartia is usually translated tragic flaw or fatal flaw. But really, it would be better to translate the word hamartia as error. Why? Because Aristotle clearly does not see the hamartia as a vice or a moral flaw. Instead, he says he's not vicious, he's not immoral, but he has a hamartia. So, again, we always call it a tragic or fatal flaw, but it would be better to call it an error. Let me explain practically. Most readers of Oedipus generally blame Oedipus's tragic fall on what? Pride. You all know the Greek word hubris, right? Overweening pride. Again, high school English teachers always talk about that. But think about it. It is really not his pride that leads to his downfall in the play. It is, I would argue, his good qualities that lead to the tragic revelation of his birth. What drives him to find out who he is? Two things. His love and unswerving devotion to truth. And number two, the love of his people. Because until he solves the riddle, the plague is going to continue. So again, we always want to say it's pride, pride, pride. But really, the tragic revelation at the end is his good qualities. It's his love and his devotion to truth. Now, this full-blown concept of tragic flaw, as most of us think about it, is really more indicative of Shakespearean tragedy. If you think about it, all of Shakespeare's tragic heroes have some kind of vice. For Hamlet, it is sloth. For King Lear, it is vanity. For Othello, it is jealousy. For Macbeth, it's avarice. For Antony, it's lust. It's almost as if Shakespeare was working his way through what they call the seven deadly sins. See, that view that there's one kind of vice and sloth, by the way, is a deadly sin, the couch potato sin. That's something that's really Shakespearean. It's not Sophoclean. My question then, and maybe your question is, why then do so many readers, and especially English teachers, want to find a tragic flaw in every tragedy they read? Because they want to. I think the reason is that we have an innate desire to blame the victim. What does that mean? You all know. What happens when a woman is raped? What do people say? Oh, she was out late, or she shouldn't have been wearing that provocative clothing. Now, if only men said that, we could say it was sexist. But women, although they don't say it, think it. Sometimes women think it more than men. They don't say it because they have a little more class than we do sometimes. But that's what I call blaming the victim. Now, why do we want to blame the victim? Because it gives us a sense of control. You know what that means? If it's true that every woman who stays out late or wears provocative clothing is going to get raped, then that means that if you don't do those two things, you'll never get raped. Well, I wish that were true, but it's not. It's like this idea that if you never eat barbecue food, you won't get cancer. This is something Texans hate. Well, no, okay? I mean, smoking is pretty closely tied to cancer. But other than that, you know, again, people just get cancer. We want to blame the victim because we want control. Like the little kids that say, oh, you've got acne because you eat too much sugar. What child doesn't eat too much sugar? Again, it wants to give us a sense of control. And so I think, at least, that's the reason why we blame the victim. I think that's something we've slightly imposed on Greek tragedy and on Aristotle. All right, according to Aristotle, the best tragedies show a good man who, on account of this error, or hamartia, moves from good fortune to bad fortune. And the reason he thinks that's the best is because this movement from good to bad fortune elicits pity and fear. Now, I will explain in a moment why pity and fear are so important, but let's talk about it. Because Aristotle is, systematic and logical. He says that there's four options. You can have a bad man who goes from good to bad. But that doesn't elicit pity and fear. That just makes you feel smugly satisfied. All right, you can have a bad man who goes from bad fortune to good fortune. But that only arouses disgust. There's nothing tragic about that or even interesting. The third option is a good man who moves from bad to good fortune. Now, that makes us feel happy, but it does not inspire either pity or fear. The only, and again, notice all these permutations and combinations. That's what it's like reading Aristotle. It's like reading a logical proof. The only one that works is a good man with a flaw who goes from good fortune to bad fortune. That evokes pity and fear. Because pity is evoked when we watch a good man suffer undeservedly. And Oedipus does not deserve his suffering. And fear is evoked when we realize the same thing may happen to us. Now, I told you in the last lecture, that doesn't mean we're afraid to kill our father and marry our mother, but we're afraid to find out something bad about ourselves. Basically, pity draws us towards somebody, whereas fear draws us away. For pity, the character has to be good. For fear, he's got to have a likeness to human nature. You see how Aristotle weaves all these things together? Now, I mentioned pity and fear. Why is that important? The reason it's important is because Aristotle says that there's not only a perfect kind of plot and a correct kind of character, there's a correct kind of response to tragedy. And he calls that response, that tragic pleasure, if you will, catharsis. According to Aristotle, the experience of a great tragedy so arouses in us the emotions of pity and fear as to lead to a catharsis of those emotions. Somehow pity and fear are linked to catharsis. Unfortunately, Aristotle says that and moves on. But he's given a lot of work for other theorists who try to figure out what he was talking about. This is funny. In the history of critical theory, there's lots of these one-liners where that's all that's said, and it's up to later people to figure out what it meant. Well, there are at least three different ways to translate the Greek word catharsis. Purgation, purification, and clarification. And around those three translations are three different theories of catharsis. And I want to go through those three theories right now. First, the purgation theory. That is the oldest theory. According to the purgation theory of catharsis, tragedy is a therapeutic experience that works on us like an enema or an emetic. Yuck, okay? In other words, this is therapeutic. What do I mean? In other words, tragedy cleanses us of our emotions of pity and fear, and thus leaves us more fit and able to face the rigors of life. Again, it's literally like an enema. You get all excited, all your pity and fear is roused, and then it goes whoosh. And there's that old-fashioned idea that the remedy for all ills is an enema, right? Well, this is, and it's not just an individual, but it's a public enema because everybody's watching the stage. Kind of grotesque, but that's the idea of a therapeutic response. That tragedy, we experience it, and it's heightened, and then it washes away. Now, this view of catharsis is the one I told you in Lecture 2 that Plato should have adopted, because it suggests that tragedy can help us wash away, on a group level, our baser emotions. The example from Oedipus? When viewing Oedipus, the tragic end of the hero is so pitiful and fearful, so emotionally overwhelming, that we leave the theater feeling drained, as if our emotions have been swept away on a tide. You know when I feel that the most? When I listen to The Ring Cycle by Wagner. I don't know if you've ever listened to Wagner. You got to really listen. When you finish, you are just drained emotionally. I mean, it's just a sort of feeling. It's not a bad feeling, but you're almost in a state of suspension. That's what catharsis as purgation means. You're just purged away from all these emotions that are raised in the tragedy. Let's look at the second. According to the purification theory of catharsis, tragedy does not so much purge our emotions as purify them. And if the purgation theory is therapeutic, the purification theory is more spiritual. Just as God uses suffering to strengthen our resolve and faith, just so the hot furnace of tragedy tests and tries our emotions like gold in the fire. According to the Judeo-Christian ethic, basically, that's one of the reasons God uses suffering, right? To purify us, to strengthen us. And you all know that you almost never find pure gold in nature. Gold always has baser metals attached to it. The way you get pure gold is you take the gold and you put it in a furnace and you heat it. And the hotter it gets, what happens is the baser materials, which are, quote, weaker, they fall out. We call that dross. And what is left is pure gold. That's the purification theory. To experience Oedipus, to see that a man can so rise above himself as to put self-discovery ahead of all else, is to have one's emotions raised to a higher level. In the end, we are left with a strange sense of calm. Not so much purged as purified. We feel strengthened, more in a religious or spiritual sense than in a therapeutic bodily sense. Let's look now at the third view called the clarification theory of catharsis. That is the most recent, and again, it's a little bit off because it doesn't mention pity and fear much, but I think there's a truth to it. According to the clarification theory, tragedy sparks in us an intellectual response. Not therapeutic, not spiritual, but intellectual. A searing moment of perfect clarity. In this almost mystical moment of enlightenment, our ill-defined emotions are carried up into a higher realm of balanced, harmonious rationality, a realm where the higher patterns and forces of the cosmos are made suddenly visible. How's that for a mouthful? You know what I'm talking about? I'm talking about what we today call the aha experience. That moment when the light bulb flashes, when suddenly everything makes sense and comes together. That is the clarification theory of catharsis. It is my goal in this lecture series to give you one of those clarifications at least once in every lecture, if not more times. I want that light bulb to flash for you to say, aha, I understand now. James Joyce called it an epiphany, that moment when everything comes together. This, I would argue, is how we feel at the end of Oedipus when we realize that Oedipus must suffer. For if he does not, the prophecy will have been proven untrue and fate will have been exposed as arbitrary and chaotic. You'll remember in Lecture 3 I told you there's a point where Oedipus thinks he has escaped his fate. Well, we're real happy. But not exactly, because we're happy, but if Oedipus escapes, that means the prophecy is false. And that means you can't trust prophecy, and therefore everything's arbitrary and hectic. And so, when Oedipus is destroyed at the end, in a weird way, we're happy. Happy because order and balance and prophecy have been restored. Let me give you a perfect example. You've all seen an enactment of the Passion Play, either on stage or in the movies. And we all know what's going to happen to Christ. We know he's going to be crucified, and we know the ending. But that doesn't stop us during the watching of the Passion Play, hoping he will be set free. That great dramatic moment when Pilate allows the Jews to choose between Jesus and Barabbas. We're hoping against hope that Jesus will be chosen and set free, and yet we know that that won't happen. But even more important, we know that it can't happen. Because if Jesus is let free, according to Christianity, salvation is finished and we're still in our sins. And so at the end of the tragedy of Christ, if you will, although that tragedy has a happy ending, the resurrection, if we stop at the crucifixion, though, that is a tragedy. And we experience a catharsis, an intellectual moment of epiphany, when we say, yes, this is the way it must be. I wish it weren't that way, but this is the way it must be. That's catharsis as clarification. Let me give you one more example. Catharsis of clarification is actually still used today, but in a psychoanalytical setting, to signify that moment when the connections between a patient's past experiences and present neuroses are suddenly revealed. Most of you are familiar with Freudian psychoanalysis. Maybe some of you have done this. They try to dredge up these old memories and try to release them. And what happens, what's supposed to happen in psychotherapy, is as you re-experience the past and see the truth about yourself, there is a catharsis. You suddenly realize what the real motives are to your actions. That really is a kind of catharsis. And psychoanalysts use the word catharsis in this way. As clarification. All right. In addition to his views on plot, character, and catharsis, Aristotle set down a number of other mandates that have become linchpins of critical theory. And what I'm going to talk about now is going to come up again and again in this lecture series, because these are the linchpins around which much of critical theory is hung. First of all, from Aristotle, and I'm still talking about the Poetics, from Aristotle comes the notion that a critic can inspire great art. We must remember that Aristotle was not a contemporary of Sophocles. Many people think that he lived during the time of Sophocles, but Sophocles lived in the 5th century during the Golden Age of Athens, the day of Sophocles and Euripides and Aeschylus, all these great tragedians. Aristotle lived in the 4th century. By the time Aristotle was living, Athens had lost her golden age and was on a downward track. Now, Athens was still making tragedies that were okay, but nothing like the perfection of Sophocles and Aeschylus and Euripides. It is clear to me, at least, that Aristotle hoped that by defining clearly the key qualities of Sophoclean tragedy, he might help usher in a new golden age, right? Maybe if I can figure it out and write this and inspire, I'll create another Sophocles. Now, this is the method he did. The role of the critic, there's two steps to it, according to this idea. First, he must assess and adumbrate the elements that make art successful. In other words, the critic takes Sophocles' Oedipus, everybody knows it's great, and figure out why it's great. Those are the elements. Then what you do is you take those elements and turn them into criteria that will teach people how to make other great works of art. Notice now the critic has the role of inspiring poetry. Unfortunately, Aristotle did not initiate a new golden age. Alexander the Great came in and knocked out Athens and moved the center of power to Macedonia. But, interestingly enough, the French neoclassical period, a couple thousand years later, produced a man named Racine and other tragedians who actually followed Aristotle to the letter and produced great tragedies. Also, we might say, as I mentioned before, the golden age of Hollywood, those great movies, they followed Aristotle as well. Let's look at another thing Aristotle added to literary theory. As we saw above, Aristotle advised that the hero be of kingly rank. And from Aristotle to our day, it was just taken for granted that tragedy must be about a noble character, an aristocrat, a prince, a king. You do not write tragedies about commoners or peasants. You write comedies about peasants. That taste that Aristotle gave us did not break down until about 100 years ago. It started with Heinrich Ibsen in the late 19th century, who wrote A Doll's House, and Hedda Gabler wrote about middle-class heroes. And then in our country, the great Arthur Miller wrote Death of a Salesman, a very serious tragedy about a really lower middle-class salesman who is not heroic in any way. And so, but really, it's not until the last 100 years that Aristotle's concept of tragedy broke down. You want to know something that most people don't know? We noticed before that Aristotle preferred tragedies with unhappy endings, right? A good man that goes from good to bad fortune. Most of you are saying, duh, that's what tragedy is. In in the 5th century BC, there are tragedies that have happy endings. Does that blow your mind? It blows your mind because Aristotle taught us, quote, the proper taste. After Aristotle, tragedies have unhappy endings. But there were happy-ended tragedies, believe it or not, in ancient Greece. Another thing Aristotle did for us, another linchpin. Aristotle basically invented the notion of genre and genre studies. I think you all know the word genre. There's poetry, but there are genres of poetry. There's epic, there's tragedy, there's lyric. Those are genres. Now, not only did Aristotle divide poetry into different forms, he actually distinguishes between epic and tragic and lyric, but he granted each form its own special criteria and mode of imitation. So not only is poetry different from philosophy, but poetry itself is broken down further. Here's that systematic thinker I told you Aristotle was. He breaks it down and he says there are certain things that are appropriate to certain genres. In fact, different genres imitate in a slightly different way. He believed, in other words, that there was a proper mode that was natural to each genre. A notion that is at the heart of all later theories of decorum. Now, in the next unit, Unit 2, I'll explain decorum in quite complexity. But just to tell you, decorum tells you what is proper or is not proper for any given type of poem. And Aristotle started us in the direction that this is proper or this is not proper. Decorum we'll talk about in the next unit, but keep that word in mind. Indeed, Aristotle believed so strongly that each genre must follow its own natural internal laws that he, very unplatonically, defended the presence in poetry of irrational elements if such were befitting the genre. In other words, he said, if this genre calls for irrationality, put it in. That's good. Plato would have been horrified. But Aristotle believes that, you know, you've got to follow the rules of that genre. Now, the great critic Coleridge, whom we'll be looking at in Unit 4, he terms this genial criticism. Genial criticism is criticism that judges a poem on its own internal merits. You know what an example of ungenial criticism is? I hate movie critics that are unfair to movies. In other words, they attack a movie for being sentimental when that's what the movie wants to be and intends to be and should be. So what they're doing is not telling you what that movie was, but they're telling you it's not the kind of movie I like. Well, they should be fair and say that. See, that's not genial criticism when you judge poetry by standards that are external to it. You've got to say, what is the poet, or in this case, the director, trying to do, and see if he fulfills what he's trying to do. That's genial criticism. Now, in addition to this, Aristotle initiated the aesthetic desire to rank genres in terms of refinement. In other words, Aristotle said all genres are not equal. Certain genres are better than others. And he put tragedy as the supreme genre and epic right underneath it, and then lyric. So he ranks the genres. And this is interesting. He bases his ranking partly on the responses of a cultivated audience. Now, remember I told you pragmatic theories are interested in the relationship between the poem and the audience? Well, Aristotle is kind of foreshadowing pragmatic theory when he says the best way to decide what is the most refined kind of art is to figure out what appeals to a refined kind of audience. Again, the audience of the teaching company, of course. Another thing, Aristotle, again, everything comes out of Aristotle, it's amazing. Aristotle initiated an organic theory of poetry that was later revived, again, by Samuel Taylor Coleridge and others. What does that mean? Aristotle treated tragedy as a living organism that must be true to its own laws. In other words, he almost acts as if the poem is alive and therefore has a kind of biochemistry, if you will. Remember he said that a tragedy should be able to resolve itself, not the deus ex machina? That's an organic view, that we want to look at the poem as a living thing. He felt a perfect tragedy was one to which nothing could either be added or subtracted without affecting the work as a whole. I am an organic unit. If you add something to me or take something away, I'm different. I'm not, quote, perfect. Well, it's the same way. You've got to treat a tragedy or a poem in general as an organic whole, something living, something that's related to itself and follows laws, just again, like the biochemical laws of our bodies. He also privileged unified plots in which all parts were related organically. In other words, because of his organic view of tragedy, he believed that everything should be related organically. So this organic theory is linked to the theory of being unified. And it's hard to say which is the chicken and which is the egg, but they sort of bounce against each other. Not only organic, but unified. Another thing Aristotle gave us. Amazing man. Aristotle praises poetry as a synthesis of history and philosophy. He says that actually poetry is better than either history or philosophy. Why? Because it combines the qualities of both. Like history, poetry works, and particularly tragedy, works with concrete particulars. In other words, tragedy is interested in things that happen, facts and figures like history. It's very concrete and particular. But added to this is what is good or noble about philosophy. Philosophy works with universal truths, right? History is interested in particulars, but not universals. Philosophy is interested in universals, but not particulars. Tragedy and poetry in general brings the two together. What is called a concrete universal. It can be specific and general at the same time. And so in that sense, it's better than both. This notion profoundly influenced many critics, particularly Kant, Coleridge, and a group we call the New Critics. And I will have lectures on each one of them as we move through this series. Very quickly, Aristotle includes a brief section on linguistics in the study of poetry. In other words, in talking about poetry, he talks about words. And a lot of modern theory is interested in linguistics. I'm not going to focus too much on that in this series, but I want you to know that the linguistic focus also goes back to Aristotle. Needless to say, critical theory would not have followed the same course had Aristotle never lived to write the Poetics. It is probably the single most important work in critical theory, and that's why I gave it two lectures. I've saved myself a minute because I promised you in the last lecture I would tell you the riddle of the Sphinx in case you don't know. The riddle of the Sphinx says, what is it, what creature is it that walks on four legs in the morning, two legs in the afternoon, and three legs in the evening? And the answer is man. Because when we're young, we crawl on all fours as a baby. As a grown man, we walk erect on two legs. As an old man, two legs and a cane. Now that's interesting because the answer to the riddle of the Sphinx is man. The answer to the riddle of Oedipus is a man, Oedipus, who turns out to be the son of Laius. Isn't that interesting? All right, in our next lecture, Lecture 5, we will move into our second unit, which will take up neoclassical theory.